Chapter 32. Held it open before me and said, "There, now, tell her to her face you could have stayed to see her, and you wouldn't." That second glimpse broke down my good resolution. I would stay, and take the risk. That night we smoked the tranquil pipe, and talked till late about various things, but mainly about her, and certainly I had had no such pleasant and restful time for many a day. The Thursday followed and slipped comfortably away. Toward twilight a big miner from 3 miles away came one of the grizzled, stranded pioneers and gave us warm salutation, clothed in grave and sober speech. Then he said, "I only just dropped over to ask about the little madam, and when is she coming home? Any news from her?"
"Oh, yes, a letter. Would you like to hear it, Tom?"
"Well, I should think I would, if you don't mind, Henry." Henry got the letter out of his wallet, and said he would skip some of the private phrases, if we were willing. Then he went on, and read the bulk of it, a loving, sedate, and altogether charming, and gracious piece of handiwork, with a postscript full of affectionate regards and messages to Tom, and Joe, and Charlie, and other close friends and neighbors. As the reader finished, he glanced at Tom, and cried out, "Oh, oh, you're at it again. Take your hands away, and let me see your eyes. You always do that, when I read a letter from her. I will write and tell her."
"Oh no, you mustn't, Henry. I'm getting old, you know, and any little disappointment makes me want to cry. I thought she'd be here herself, and now you've got only a letter."
"Well, now, what put that in your head?"
"I thought everybody knew she wasn't coming till Saturday."
"Saturday? Why, come to think, I did know it. I wonder what's the matter with me lately?
Certainly I knew it. Ain't we all getting ready for her?
Well, I must be going now. But I'll be on hand when she comes, old man." Late Friday afternoon another gray veteran tramped over from his cabin a mile or so away, and said the boys wanted to have a little gaiety, and a good time Saturday night, if Henry thought she wouldn't be too tired after her journey to be kept up.
"Tired? She tired?
Oh, hear the man. Joe, you know she'd sit up 6 weeks, to please any one of you." When Joe heard that there was a letter, he asked to have it read, and the loving messages in it for him broke the old fellow all up. But he said he was such an old wreck that that would happen to him if she only just mentioned his name.
"Ord, we miss her so," he said.
Saturday afternoon I found I was taking out my watch pretty often. Henry noticed it, and said, with a startled look, "You don't think she ought to be here soon, do you?" I felt caught, and a little embarrassed, but I laughed, and said it was a habit of mine, when I was in a state of expectancy. But he didn't seem quite satisfied, and from that time on he began to show uneasiness. 4 times he walked me up the road to a point whence we could see a long distance, and there he would stand, shading his eyes with his hand, and looking. Several times he said, "I'm getting worried, I'm getting right down worried. I know she's not due till about 9 o'clock, and yet something seems to be trying to warn me that something's happened."
"You don't think anything has happened, do you?"
I began to get pretty thoroughly ashamed of him for his childishness, and at last, when he repeated that imploring question still another time, I lost my patience for the moment, and spoke pretty brutally to him. It seemed to shrivel him up and cow him, and he looked so wounded, and so humble after that, that I detested myself for having done the cruel and unnecessary thing. And so I was glad when Charlie, another veteran, arrived toward the edge of the evening, and nestled up to Henry, to hear the letter read, and talked over the preparations for the welcome. Charlie fetched out one hearty speech after another, and did his best to drive away his friend's bodings and apprehensions.
"Anything happened to her?"
"Henry, that's pure nonsense. There isn't anything going to happen to her. Just make your mind easy as to that."
"What did the letter say?"
"Said she was well, didn't it?
And said she'd be here by 9 o'clock, didn't it?
Did you ever know her to fail of her word?"
Why, you know you never did.
Well then, don't you fret. She'll be here, and that's absolutely certain, and as sure as you are born.
Come now, let's get to decorating, not much time left.
Pretty soon Tom and Joe arrived, and then all hands set about adorning the house with flowers.
Toward 9 the three miners said that as they had brought their instruments they might as well tune up, for the boys and girls would soon be arriving now, and hungry for a good, old-fashioned breakdown.
A fiddle, a banjo, and a clarinet, these were the instruments.
The trio took their places side by side, and began to play some rattling dance music, and beat time with their big boots.
It was getting very close to 9.
Henry was standing in the door with his eyes directed up the road, his body swaying to the torture of his mental distress. He had been made to drink his wife's health and safety several times, and now Tom shouted,
"All hands stand by! One more drink, and she's here!"
Joe brought the glasses on a waiter, and served the party.
I reached for one of the two remaining glasses, but Joe growled under his breath,
"Drop that! Take the other,"
which I did.
Henry was served last. He had hardly swallowed his drink when the clock began to strike. He listened till it finished, his face growing pale and paler. Then he said,
"Boys, I'm sick with fear. Help me, I want to lie down."
They helped him to the sofa. He began to nestle and drowse, but presently spoke like one talking in his sleep, and said,
"Did I hear horses' feet? Have they come?"
One of the veterans answered, close to his ear.
T was Jimmy Parrish come to say the party got delayed, but they're right up the road a piece, and coming along.
Her horse is lame, but she'll be here in half an hour.
Oh, I'm so thankful nothing has happened.
He was asleep almost before the words were out of his mouth.
In a moment those handy men had his clothes off, and had tucked him into his bed in the chamber, where I had washed my hands.
They closed the door and came back.
Then they seemed preparing to leave, but I said,
"Please don't go, gentlemen. She won't know me, I am a stranger."
They glanced at each other.
Then Joe said,
"She? Poor thing, she's been dead 19 years.
Dead?
That or worse. She went to see her folks half a year after she was married, and on her way back, on a Saturday evening, the Indians captured her within 5 miles of this place, and she's never been heard of since.
And he lost his mind in consequence?
Never has been sane an hour since.
But he only gets bad when that time of year comes round.
Then we begin to drop in here, 3 days before she's due, to encourage him up, and ask if he's heard from her, and Saturday we all come, and fix up the house with flowers, and get everything ready for a dance. We've done it every year for 19 years. The first Saturday there was 27 of us, without counting the girls. There's only 3 of us now, and the girls are gone. We drug him to sleep, or he would go wild. Then he's all right for another year, thinks she's with him till the last 3 or 4 days come round. Then he begins to look for her, and gets out his poor old letter, and we come and ask him to read it to us.
Lord, she was a darling.
A helpless situation. Once or twice a year I get a letter of a certain pattern, a pattern that never materially changes, in form and substance, yet I cannot get used to that letter. It always astonishes me. It affects me as the locomotive always affects me.
I saw to myself, I have seen you 1,000 times, you always look the same way, yet you are always a wonder, and you are always impossible. To contrive you is clearly beyond human genius. You can't exist, you don't exist, yet here you are.
I have a letter of that kind by me, a very old one. I yearn to print it, and where is the harm? The writer of it is dead years ago, no doubt, and if I conceal her name, and address her this world address, I am sure her shade will not mind.
And with it, I wish to print the answer which I wrote at the time, but probably did not send.
If it went, which is not likely, it went in the form of a copy, for I find the original still here, pigeonholed with the said letter.
To that kind of letters we all write answers which we do not send, fearing to hurt where we have no desire to hurt. I have done it many a time, and this is doubtless a case of the sort. The letter, X, California, June 3, 1879. Mr. S. 50. Clemens, Hartford, Con. Colon, Dear Sir, you will doubtless be surprised to know who has presumed to write and ask a favor of you. Let your memory go back to your days in the humble mines 62-63. You will remember, you and Clagett and Oliver and the old blacksmith Till who lived in a lean-to which was halfway up the gulch, and there were six log cabins in the camp strung pretty well separated up the gulch from its mouth at the desert to where the last claim was, at the divide. The lean-to you lived in was the one with a canvas roof, that the cow fell down through one night, as told about by you in Roughing It. My Uncle Simmons remembers it very well. He lived in the principal cabin, halfway up the divide, along with Dixon and Parker and Smith. It had two rooms, one for kitchen and the other for bunks, and was the only one that had. You and your party were there on the great night, the time they had dried apple pie. Uncle Simmons often speaks of it. It seems curious that dried apple pie should have seemed such a great thing, but it was, and it shows how far Humboldt was out of the world and difficult to get to, and how slim the regular bill of fare was. 16 years ago, it is a long time. I was a little girl then, only 14. I never saw you, I lived in Washoe. But Uncle Simmons ran across you every now and then, all during those weeks that you and party were there working your claim which was like the rest. The camp played out long and long ago, there wasn't silver enough in it to make a button. You never saw my husband, but he was there after you left, and lived in that very lean-to, a bachelor then, but married to me now. He often wishes there had been a photographer there in those days, he would have taken the lean-to. He got hurt in the old Al Clayton claim that was abandoned like the others, putting in a blast, and not climbing out quick enough, though he scrambled the best he could. It landed him clear down on the train and hit a Paiute. For weeks they thought he would not get over it, but he did, and is all right now. Has been ever since. This is a long introduction, but it is the only way I can make myself known. The favor I ask I feel assured your generous heart will grant. Give me some advice about a book I have written. I do not claim anything for it, only it is mostly true, and as interesting as most of the books of the times. I am unknown in the literary world, and you know what that means, unless one has someone of influence, like yourself, to help you, by speaking a good word for you. I would like to place the book on royalty basis plan with anyone you would suggest. This is a secret from my husband and family. I intend it as a surprise in case I get it published. Feeling you will take an interest in this, and if possible write me a letter to some publisher, or, better still, if you could see them for me, and then let me hear. I appeal to you to grant me this favor. With deepest gratitude I thank you for your attention. One knows, without inquiring, that the twin of that embarrassing letter is forever and ever flying in this and that, and the other direction across the continent in the mails, daily, nightly, hourly, unceasingly, unrestingly. It goes to every well-known merchant, and railway official, and manufacturer, and capitalist, and mayor, and congressman, and governor, and editor, and publisher, and author, and broker, and banker, in a word, to every person who is supposed to have influence. It always follows the one pattern. Who do not know me, but you once knew a relative of mine, etc., etc. We should all like to help the applicants. We should all be glad to do it, we should all like to return the sort of answer that is desired, but well, there is not a thing we can do that would be a help, for not in any instance does that latter ever come from anyone who can be helped. The struggler whom you could help, does his own helping. It would not occur to him to apply to you, stranger. He has talent and knows it, and he goes into his fight eagerly, and with energy and determination all alone. Preferring to be alone. That pathetic letter which comes to you from the incapable, the unhelpable, how do you who are familiar with it answer it? What do you find to say?
You do not want to inflict a wound. You hunt ways to avoid that.
What do you find?
How do you get out of your hard place with a content conscience?
Do you try to explain?
The old reply of mine to such a letter shows that I tried that once.
Was I satisfied with the result?
Possibly, and possibly not,
probably not,
almost certainly not.
I have long ago forgotten all about it.
But, anyway, I append my effort.
The reply, I know Mr. H, and I will go to him.
Dear madam, if upon reflection you find you still desire it, there will be a conversation.
I know the form it will take.
It will be like this.
Mr. H, how do her books strike you?
Mr. Clemens, I am not acquainted with them.
Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.